Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Hello, my name is Devin Martin. Welcome to the Currency podcast. This morning, I'm joined by my fellow American, Jacob Claflin, who is the founder and CEO of Cambrist, which is an Irish fintech company. Great to have you on the pod, Jacob.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start off here, before we really get rolling, to give those audience members of ours a sense who might not be too familiar with the intricacies of foreign transactions. What is Cambrist? What do they do?
So Cambrist is a very specialized fintech. We focus very specifically on the foreign exchange element of Visa and MasterCard payments. And, you know, as part of this conversation, I'll tell you about my sort of light bulb moment and how I came to decide to go on this crazy journey. But at the end of the day, when people travel around the world, particularly before COVID hit and we were all locked down, there's a lot of intricacy in how those payments are processed and how that money is managed between all the different parties. And frankly, there's lots of inefficiency. And we just felt like my team and I were in a really good position to build a business making that process better for everyone involved.
So you spent your career in the payments industry, grew up not far away from where I did in Maine. But I want to start here with where I think most great stories start, which is at the beginning. How did you first get into the sector and what was your journey from there?
So if you want to start at the beginning, then I need to go back to when I left university. So it was mid-90s. I was, you know, again, born in the States, went to school in Chicago. You know, the Berlin Wall had fallen, you know, a few years earlier. I'm not that old, but it did happen around the time when I was still in school. And it just sort of, you know, gave me all this great energy about what was happening in Eastern Europe. And so I graduated from university and I convinced my parents that I was going to spend the summer after graduation traveling around Eastern Europe and then I was going to come home. Honestly, really didn't have a plan, but just convinced them that that's what I was going to do. And so I got my graduation gift, jumped on the airplane, landed in Warsaw, Poland, and started just traveling around the region. I had an amazing time, spent all my money within a matter of months and had to make a decision. Do I look for work and just kind of stick it out here? This part of the world was really just transforming at a pace I didn't think was possible. Or go back to the US, which for me seemed like going backwards in time in a way. And frankly, I got lucky. There was an American company that two really brilliant people who I now consider sort of mentors and really almost heroes in a way, they had founded a business called Euronet. And this business was based in Hungary, but was operating all over Central and Eastern Europe. And it was growing like crazy. And frankly, they took a risk. They hired this guy off a street in Warsaw to join this growing business. They're in payments. They were doing ATMs at the time. They got into a ton of different areas. And really, that became my entry point into the payments industry. This, you know, one decision about where I would take a job ended up being the career that I have now. And I got lucky on multiple steps because that company was growing so fast that I spent 10 years with them. But I worked, you know, in probably six or seven different countries, always being challenged, always moving into a different role that stretched my boundaries because the company was always trying to do more and it was always asking more of its people. And frankly, I was at a point in my life where if you said, get on an airplane because there's something that we need done, you know, in this market, I was there and I didn't think twice. And it was brilliant.
And where did Ireland come into the equation?
So I left that company again after about 10, 12 years. I actually went back to the U.S. for a year. It had been quite a while. I realized I got a bit of kind of a reverse shock, if you will, after living in Central and Eastern Europe for a good part of my life and then going back to sort of Middle America, didn't transition well, frankly. And I decided at one point that, you know what, I want to go back to Europe. But I want to go back with a different company. I was ready for a bit of a change. And I found an opportunity. There was a new company out of Austin, Texas. Again, another American payments company that was a little bit younger, had just completed Series A, so had a bunch of money in the bank and big ambitions, and they hired me to launch their European operations. And so we kind of plotted our strategy. Where were we going to do this from? Would we go to London? Would we go to Amsterdam? But honestly, Dublin just sort of fit in a variety of ways. So I parachuted into Dublin, and this was 2008, set up that company's operations, and then just began working that business. And that business was doing sort of like Revolut-style prepaid travel cards before Revolut really existed. So that was my gateway into sort of the cross-border payments arm of payments. But so that's why I landed in Dublin. And I stayed in that business for about 4 years before it was going through its own growing pains. And I realized that I was kind of tired of being somebody else's employee. I was a little bit frustrated with some of the decisions that were happening in that business, and had been on enough of a journey that said, you know what, I think I can do this. Hmm. And, you know, the rest is history.
So when you say, I think I can do this, you know, did you have an idea of I can do this better? Did you hone in on a sector of the industry that you thought, I can improve on this?
Very, very much so. And that goes back to that point about, you know, I think entrepreneurs commonly talk about the thing that sort of sparked them, right? And for me, I was traveling all over Europe. So my whole career, I was traveling constantly, pretty much every week for different things. And whether I was based in Warsaw or based in Hungary or based in Romania or based in Ireland, it was really common that I was traveling around. And I'm, you know, obviously I've got my AIB Visa card in my wallet, but I'm traveling to all these different places. And this may sound silly, but being in the world of payments, I know just enough to know when something's kind of not quite right. And what wasn't quite right for me, and again, this is where it gets into the woods, and I don't want to, you know, get your audience, you know, into the weeds too much, but when I was spending, you know, my Euro card in Sweden or even in London, you know, you'd pay £100 in London, and then you'd look at your bank statement and it's, you know, 115 euro, and you don't know where that number came from. What, how did it become, you know, how did that exchange rate hit me? What is that fee that's so expensive? Drove me crazy. Just that lack of transparency, that lack of control. I felt like I was being abused and I didn't have any control over it. And it really, really just frustrated me. And because it was such a constant pain point for me, and frankly, I was expensing stuff to be repaid for my the company I was to work with, and I'd have accountants looking at this, you know, frustrated as well. And so it just became this underlying issue, and it was always burning in the back of my mind. And so when I was getting ready, sort of mentally and emotionally, to leave that last company that brought me to Ireland, because we'd been in the space doing these multi-currency travel cards, we'd learned enough about the mechanisms that can make that part of payments a little bit more efficient. Now, those businesses, again, this was pre-Revolut, those businesses were always really pretty niche. You know, there's companies like Travelex or different small-scale businesses that would put those cards in the market, but they never really got huge, not like what we're seeing today. And frankly, I had big ambitions. And so I said, I don't want to just create a new Jacob's card and put it out there and see what happens. I'm a B2B guy. I'm an enterprise guy. All the companies I'd worked with, we'd been selling and working with large banks. That's what I knew. That's what I was comfortable with. And so what I really wanted was I wanted that AIB card in my wallet to give me all the cool stuff that, again, I keep referencing Revolut because it's such a good example, but I wanted all that cool stuff in my traditional bank card. Right? It drove me nuts that it wasn't available to me. Because I have a wallet with a bunch of plastic. I don't need another piece of plastic. I want the piece of plastic that I have today to be better. And so that kind of drive and that goal layered onto the fact, you know, I'm a guy who's done a lot of different jobs. You know, I did some project management, I did some product management, all these titles that kind of mean I was in different roles that gave me a lot of broad experience. And so I knew enough that I knew that there was a way to make this better. And I had previously worked with some really smart guys who were also a bit frustrated with the business they were in, who I pulled in to be my co-founders. One guy is now our head of product. The other guy is our CTO. And so the three of us really created this really strong triangle because we could all support each other. I had more of the business and finance. The product is covered. The tech is covered. We knew when we sat down, we said, look, we think we can build the equivalent of a software as a service, black box, that we can plug into an AIB. We can plug into a Barclays, whomever, and we can enable them to give us all that cool stuff that I've been looking for. And that was really, as simple as that sounds, that was really the top line objective. Build this box. In effect, what I really wanted to do, if I summarize it, is I wanted to take credit and debit cards out of the 1950s, which is basically where they've been, and through force of will, bring them into the modern age and connect them through our technology to banking as a service platforms, wholesale FX markets, all this stuff that I knew was out there. I wanted to be the enabler of that. And I wanted to create a business by being the infrastructure that enables that.
Right. So it's one thing to have a great idea, but it's a whole nother feat to build a business to the scale that you've built it. So what did sort of the timeline look like for you at the beginning? Did you look for investors? Did you build your team first?
So the two co-founders and I, we spent the better part of 9 months self-funding. Well, really the first year, truly self-funding. So I had enough savings that I could fend for myself. We could, you know, put some money into the business, make sure some of the guys had some salary coming in. But really, we were doing two things at once. We were trying to vet our idea. So I had a few contacts in banks across Europe that I'd worked with in the past that we were engaging with. And, you know, really what we're doing is we're selling. We're trying to convince somebody to be that first pilot customer, basically. And we're getting information. We're getting validation of our business model, validation that we're not completely crazy about the fact that somebody'd actually want to do this. And at the same time, we're trying to kind of architect a solution. And all of this is happening in parallel, and it all happens over a period of time. And we get great market feedback. In fact, customers have never been our challenge. You know, we made a ton of mistakes, and I'll be very frank about some of those mistakes now. But getting a bank interested in what we were doing was never the problem. And so we were, over that first year or so, we got a lot of engagement, a lot of good feedback, and we got our first pilot. It was actually with a small Irish company called Perfect Card. Over the last couple of years, it was acquired by another company called EML. But Perfect Card did cross-border gift cards. They were using Visa and MasterCard, and they're giving, you know, salary payments or like bonus payments to people. So they're a great little business based out of Greystones, and they took the punt with us. They were the first company that said, hey, we'll test your solution. And within 3 months, we were live, and it worked. We're like, this is amazing. Now, the volumes were low. It was a pilot. It wasn't a name brand tier one bank, but it was the starting point. And once we had that validation, then we did go out and we raised some money, and I was able to pull together a group of really amazing angel investors that have been with us since. So that was second quarter of 2017. Enterprise Ireland contributed to some of our first early funding, and that was where we started. And you know, then as our, you know, we got a lot of confidence. We were live. It worked. We had some money in the bank. We, you know, thought, man, this, we're going to retire, you know, in the next 5 years. This is too easy. But then some of the realities started to set in. And frankly, I think we made some of the most fundamental mistakes, if you will, in our early days. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately, because I think we've really finally found some paths for traction. But those early days, you know, you look back and you know, this is something you hear a lot, but if I thought that it was going to be this difficult, I probably wouldn't have done it. Now, entrepreneurial optimism kind of keeps you a little bit blinded. But we really, after getting live, it took us a while to get the next customer onboarded. And I can, you know, go into that more if you're interested.
Yeah, what would you have done differently if you had to start over? What would you avoid?
So what we really wanted to do, we wanted to give banks more control over a really important part of their card payments operations. And while that's a clear gap in the market, and again, we were talking to different banks of all sizes, and it was something that they were aware of. But the reality is that whether it's the payments industry or other big tech, where there's a gap doesn't necessarily mean there's not resistance to solving that problem. And particularly in payments, it's an ecosystem. Everything is connected. And when there's a gap that I saw as an inefficiency that I wanted to solve around this cross-border stuff, there are other parties that were actually benefiting from that inefficiency. That inefficiency really meant that somebody else is making money, right? I wanted the banks that were putting the cards in my pocket to make the money and have more control. But I had some really strong challenges with industry participants that didn't want that to happen. And so we kind of treaded water. For most of 2017, through early 2019, we were struggling as a business. And I'm very upfront about that. Like, again, great ecosystem of support in Ireland, Enterprise Ireland. We went through a program called New Frontiers that was really good. We did the Accenture FinTech Lab, which was a very good program for us. Got us a great partner that I'll talk about in a minute. But we weren't really generating revenue. You know, we were doing small projects. You can go into a lot of banks through their innovation teams, which is a little bit of a playground. You're not really selling, from my perspective. You're going into like Bank of Ireland's innovation desk at Grand Canal. You know, wonderful people, but you're not selling your services. You're helping them understand their own innovations that they want to do. And so we spend a lot of time doing that. A lot of time trying to muscle our way. And as a startup, you don't have a lot of muscle. You know, what you have is just unrelenting need to make this work. So we just persevered for a period of time. But there, by the end of 2019, there were really two key things that enabled us to get to a point of scale and growth. One was, and again, I'll bring up Revolut again, Revolut was killing it by this point. You know, their market cap, their growth, their sheer volume of customers. You know, in Ireland, they tell you they have 1.5 million customers right now in Ireland. You know, that's massive on a footprint of less than 100 people. You know, look at Bank of Ireland. They've got, you know, 20,000 people and, you know, slightly larger footprint. Again, the efficiencies and what they've brought to the markets that they're in really creates a competitive dynamic that people cannot ignore anymore. And the functionality that they're offering, again, we were looking at the cross-border payments element, which is the sort of the wallets, the different currency wallets that Revolut offers. That was a sweet spot that we could deliver. And so the fact that, I'll call it the Revolut effect, that pressure in a variety of markets meant that banks were really starting to pound on the table saying, we need the ability to do this. So that was a really important part of our ability to grow. But at another end, regulator. The European regulator passed a law that forced all banks to make FX totally transparent. That cost to you and I when we travel abroad again. There's now an absolute mandate that requires a lot of openness there. And those two factors, regulatory changes and market competitive pressures, meant that Canberra Services could overcome some of those sort of network challenges, those industry challenges that really kind of let us, you know, hold fast for a while.
So you mentioned your growth and expansion. Has that been a growth in employees? Has that been a growth in customers?
It has. So, you know, we've it feels like we've been in the trenches for quite a while now. So we had our first big bank go live in March of 2020 with our core service. Now, something else really important happened in March 2020. COVID really hit. So we had the best milestone month of our short lifetime, and then all of a sudden the whole world shut down. And we're in the cross-border payments business. So all of a sudden our forecasts, our models, our, you know, data and analysis, all of our stuff was no longer valid. So that kind of made us take a step back and revisit what our priorities are, which meant for most of last year, we had contracts, we had projects underway, but we're a volume business. People aren't traveling, people aren't spending, the volumes weren't there. So while we were in a really good place and our partners were motivated enough to keep everything going, there wasn't as much revenue as we had wanted. So I think we grew the team by about 6 or 7 people over 2020. But it's really just now, it's really just in the last quarter, we're starting to see volumes tick back up. So pre-COVID volumes were still down about 30%, I'd say, which means there's been a lot of recovery. But now is when we're really starting to see things happen. So right now, in the last 12 months, Cambrous has expanded. At last count, we've got 15 bank or fintech customers in about 12 countries. We have 5 more countries that we expect to open within the next 6 months. Our revenue has tripled in the span of the last 2 quarters. Will triple again by the beginning of next year. But again, small numbers. It's easy to have big percentages. But for us, every bank that we add is accretive. Every bank that we add is incrementally a major jump for us. You know, our platform, our operational cost base is relatively low. So the investment that you asked about, sorry if I'm being a bit long-winded, the investment that we're doing now is all about sales and marketing. Hiring salespeople, investing in our marketing platforms, investing in our inside sales, and frankly, investing in being a really sales-focused business. I'll go back to that point I told you about. You know, as an early stage fintech startup, if you get a meeting with a banker, I don't care which banker it is, you think you're on fire, right? But it took us a while, and it took me a while, to really understand who I'm selling to. And to understand that just because you're a fintech and you can get these meetings and everybody's so enthusiastic, you're really not selling. Unless you can go through the standard sales cycle that IBM or Oracle or anybody else has to do, you're not selling. Unless you have the depth as an organization to go through those due diligence checks, those compliance checks, you're not selling. You're having conversations. They enjoy listening to what you have going on, but they're not going to buy from you. And so we're now, you know, we have a strong foundation, but we're layering in. You know, we're improving our audit capabilities. We're improving the sort of the serviceability of the compliance on our stack. All this stuff, there's inward investment and there's outward investment. But at the end of the day, we're selling into large organizations and we need a lot of good, solid salespeople to do that. And I spend probably half my time right now just trying to identify the right people to join our team. And it's been difficult. I'll tell you, we've recently had to let someone go because it's just not the right fit for a variety of reasons. But that's a part of the journey. And so it's an exciting time for us. So I'm frankly, like I said to a friend of mine recently, I'm starting to have fun again, you know, which is great. Because if you don't enjoy the journey, man, it's a hard road.
You've just launched into Sweden. You have already a little bit of an international presence established. What is the decision making behind where you expand into as far as international?
So because we're in the currency sort of side of payments, the very first thing we look at is the currency market, the currency rates. Because at the heart of what we do, we build a pipe into a bank, and through that pipe, we enable different services around cross-border spending. And at the heart of that, you need to make money. And we make money off of the processing of FX. And if the margins are good, so we look at the Swedish market, we said, okay, people are traveling from Sweden to the Eurozone, to the UK. What's that FX market look like? Is there fat in that marketplace that we can build efficiency on and create value for our customers? And the answer was yes. And so that's why Sweden was an important market for us. You know, not every market is good for us. You know, most of the core Eurozone are not targets for cameras. Germany, France, Italy, Spain, not for us. But the UK, Scandinavia, Central and Eastern Europe, we're now in active conversations about entering Russia, probably through a partner. Turkey, again, some of these are very volatile places politically, but at the same time, where that volatility exists, there's an opportunity that we can add value in. And so, again, that currency market is very important for us. You know, we look at the regulatory environment, depending upon the service that we're going to do. Is there a regulatory, you know, kind of mandate that enables what we want to do? We've got an interesting checklist that we go through. It's not exhaustive. You know, we're not hiring consultants to assess the markets for us. We'll spend some time, we'll figure it out, and then we'll start knocking on doors. And it's really as simple as that. You pick up the phone, you try to network your way into some conversations and see if there's, you know, a meaningful opportunity.
I'd like to take a step back here and look at the fintech sector as a whole. It's a hot sector. It's one that I think most would think is competitive, but there's also a lot of room for expansion. What has it been like trying to compete in that sector? Is it saturated?
It's not saturated at all. I think, again, fintech is a really generic term for a lot of different businesses. And we actually straddle sort of the fintech and regtech space, which makes it even broader. But, you know, you've got companies out there that are doing, you know, their own card products, and they're in the fintech space. They're consumer branded services like the Monzos, you know, the Revoluts, TransferWise now, excuse me. And then you've got more of the back office companies. You hear a lot about banking as a service, Rails Bank and others, the processors. We're definitely in that back office piece. But again, the point of whether or not there's room to grow, for me, the answer is absolutely yes. You obviously need to carve out a place where you can be unique. And I think Cambrist has that uniqueness where, you know, again, we're that intermediary between legacy technology systems and new platforms that I think is a very good place for us to play. But again, you know, what fintech for me is really about is about the fact that you've got a generation of technology platforms out there that are not fit for purpose anymore. And for the vast majority, probably for 80% of the banking systems around the world, they're not built to enable the type of functionality or change that you and I would expect as of today. And so we're creating gateways so that they can, plug into us and not have to spend, you know, half of their IT budget getting a new product out there that can compete with the likes of Revolut. That for us is a really interesting space, and there's more than enough opportunity for a variety of players to be out there.
And where is that sector headed in the future? You mentioned this idea that you think there's sort of an antiquated aspect of the industry as far as what companies are doing. Do you expect to see other companies like yours, new ones pop up?
Absolutely, constantly. But they always are, and that's the brilliant part of it. You know, the story of startups and fintech is always on the move. You know, in my sector, you have companies that have been around for 15 years that still call themselves a startup, and yet they're trading hundreds of millions of euros worth of value on a regular basis, or they're being acquired at billion-dollar valuations. One of the companies that, in some ways, is a parallel to us, you know, much bigger, is a company called Currency Cloud. They were recently acquired by Visa. Visa has also acquired a company called Tink out of Scandinavia, I can't remember which country right now, but doing banking as a service. And so you've got this constant grow and, you know, be absorbed into this kind of bigger legacy infrastructure. But you also have companies that are out there just driving new change and challenging, you know, what's out there as standard. And for us, our path, again, I said we're growing so much that my focus right now is really just to make sure that the team that we have and that continues to build has got the strong foundation so that we don't stretch ourselves too thin. Because again, we're still a relatively small team, but we're all over the place. Again, excuse me, over 12 countries operating today, as far away as South Africa, and we're entering New Zealand and Australia with a partner. You can grow too fast. We've also been a bit cautious in our fundraising, and so we actually haven't raised venture rounds yet. We've been really supported by, you know, the angel groups at Enterprise Ireland, which means we don't have the funnel of money just sitting there waiting to help us, you know, do that. Now, that may be something we decide to change. But frankly, I'm always amazed when I'm on, you know, I have some calls with some of the founders that I've met over the last couple of years. We're all doing such interesting stuff. We're all, you know, finding new ways to drive value. It's there's not an end to this. It's just a constant evolution.
I'd love to hear more about your plans for the company in the future. Do you have a vision for what this company will look like?
Yeah. So, you know, you catch me on a different day and you'll probably get a different answer in terms of where we're going. You know, I don't like to talk about the end because I think we're still really just at the beginning. But today we're a purely tech company. We offer technology solutions. We connect different parts of the ecosystem, and we're really, really good at what we do. Our next journey is going to be about becoming a regulated entity. So we're going to start pursuing a payments institution license. And really what that will enable us is to start physically participating in the movement of the money that I've described, those different currencies. So getting a regulated license will give us it'll put some more responsibility on our shoulders, but it'll also give us the ability to do some more things on our own and to monetize that for our partners and for ourselves. And so that's a really important next step for us. And then it's going to be, frankly, just about more market share growth. So again, identifying those markets, identifying the people that can help us access and plant our flags in those markets is really my ambition. And making sure that we have enough both revenue as a foundation, but also enough strong investors that want to be along for the ride. So I think, you know, catch up with me in a year and I'd say we'll probably be multiple times where we are now, both in terms of the scope of our business, the services that we're offering, but also the geographies that we're covering.
What have you learned about the entrepreneurship process that you think maybe you wish you would have told your former self when you began?
Yeah, that's another question that I can come up with a bunch of different answers depending upon context. There's something that I realized not so long ago that if I really didn't enjoy the work, if I didn't enjoy kind of doing this with the people that are around me, that I get to choose, right? It's not like a normal job where you walk in and you're told this is your, you know, colleague. I get to choose who I do this with. That's a luxury, but it also puts a level of responsibility that I didn't think was really possible. Almost like you know, you fear for your family. I fear for my colleagues that this wouldn't work because they've taken some risk by putting up, you know, what were traditional careers on hold to be on this journey with us. If I wasn't really excited about that every day, I would have hung up my Canberra's hat a while ago. Again, because we had a couple of tough years when we were treading water. But that combined with just probably this really brutal stubbornness, because we were also kept being told that what we wanted to do really is just, you know, it can't be done. They're not going to let you do this. My stubbornness really just got me through it, frankly. So that love and fear for the people you're doing it with and the stubbornness not to give up, key qualities, frankly. But I think, honestly, I think early on it was being a little bit oblivious to the fact that this was going to be a bit harder than I expected. You can't be really too honest with yourself. You might not get off the couch if that's the case. But really, the journey is what it's about. It's not about the end. I mean, I think right now we're all very confident that this is going to be meaningful for the people that are with us. But who knows when that's going to be realized? You know, it could be next year, it could be 10 years. I don't know. We don't have a set deadline for how we're going to, you know, finally monetize this experience. Which means you got to enjoy it. And I've met a bunch of people in the past going through these different programs and meeting different startup founders that sometimes are maybe too focused on that end and not enough on the journey. And that's where I see people get maybe the burnout, maybe the stress. It can wear you down really easily. And so that's, for me, that's probably the most important realization.
Jacob, thanks so much for being on our podcast today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Wish you the best in the future.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.